You're listening to WFHB Bloomington at 91.3 FM, W251AG Bloomington at 98.1, W264 BP Nashville at 100.7 FM, and W292DD Ellettsville at 106.3 FM, community radio for South Central Indiana. Looks like tonight we have a 100% chance of rain and a low of 29 degrees turning into a wintry mix. So be careful, there's a winter storm warning for Friday. Thanks for tuning in to WFHB. Stay tuned. Coming up next, it's the Daily Local News.
You're tuned to WFHB.
91.3
and 98.1 FM.
Volunteer powered.
Listener supported.
Community radio from South Central Indiana.
Welcome to WFHB's Daily Local News.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers from the Bloomington community.
And supported by the generosity of listeners like you.
Good afternoon from the studios of Community Radio 91.3 FM, reporting live for WFHB. This is Carolyn Vanderweel.
And I'm Ron Bronson. This is the Daily Local News for Thursday, January 11th, 2017.
If they're innocent, their fingerprints are still collected, and if they're innocent, they got nothing to worry about. You're assuming that DNA collection is a penalty.
Later in the program, we'll hear from the ACLU and the Prosecuting Attorney's Council about an Indiana law requiring law enforcement to collect DNA from people arrested in connection with a felony.
Also coming up in the next half hour, our weekly public opinion feature, Voices in the Street, asks your friends and neighbors whether Indiana needs hate crime legislation. Indiana is one of five states that doesn't have a hate crime law on the books. That's coming up later in the program on Voices in the Street. But first, your local headlines.
Bloomington City Council members are working to limit the heights of new downtown development. In their ongoing revision of the city's comprehensive plan, council members voted unanimously to remove language that would increase building heights to achieve maximum residential density. In last night's meeting, council member Isabel Piedmont-Smith authored the amendment to strike the language from the plan. She said council members are hearing from the public that building heights downtown are already higher than the community desires.
So I think we need to have more public input before we have kind of a blanket provision in this document saying that we should consider increased building heights.
Bloomington's downtown lies largely within City Council Districts 1 and 6. District 6 Representative Steve Volan and Piedmont-Smith discussed whether her amendment could change the Plan Commission's practice of granting height waivers to developers.
My understanding, and I think we've talked about this before, is that the reason that buildings have gotten built higher than what was allowed by zoning code since 2006 is because of waivers granted by the Plan Commission. Should we not somehow be trying to get the Plan Commission to simply grant fewer height waivers? You know, we still want to use building height as a negotiating tool, but it seemed like they gave it away too often. I mean, how does this really help?
Well, I don't think it either helps or hinders the long-standing practice of allowing taller heights in exchange for some kind of community benefit or perceived community benefit by Plan Commission members. So I think that's something that should be addressed in the updated UDO. If we want tighter standards for giving variances, we need to put that in the UDO. But this also doesn't preclude that.
District 1 Representative Chris Sturbaum says the original language specifying higher downtown development immediately caught his eye, too.
And the thought that came to my mind was, who asked for more height? I really didn't have any constituents talking to me about we need more height downtown. I didn't read in Imagine Bloomington that there was an outcry for more height downtown. So I'm glad this is struck, and let's go from here.
Piedmont-Smith's amendment did not alter the comp plan language regarding, quote, diversified density calculations, end quote, but she took time to explain the concept.
Currently, we have in our UDO density calculations. We don't just simply count apartments, and we don't simply count bedrooms. We have what's called a DUE.
DUE is short for dwelling unit equivalents. Piedmont Smith says the ratio between dwelling unit equivalents and the number of apartments or bedrooms in a development is not one-to-one. In her explanation, she references last year's Bloomington Bagel Company's renovation that incorporated micro studios.
So if you have a 4 or 5 bedroom unit, it's not just a 4 or 5 DUE, it's more. And there are limits on density, of course, in various parts of downtown. So when we, on the Plan Commission, heard the Bloomington Bagel Company proposal for a new building on their old site across from People's Park, and we saw that the studio apartments in that building were really much smaller than what a studio apartment DUE calculation is, we thought, you know, this is still very attractive to people because of its location, but it's smaller, so it's a little bit more affordable. So we'd like to encourage this, but the current density calculations don't really envision something that small. So this is what we're talking about, that let's consider even smaller sizes when we're allowing density.
The council anticipates the city will begin updating its Unified Development Ordinance, or UDO, once the new comprehensive plan is approved. However, City Planning Commission Manager Scott Robinson says another planning document, the city's Downtown Vision Plan, still identifies downtown as an area for increased height as well as density. During the council's meeting last week, Volan said he knows of no plan to revise the city's Downtown Vision Plan to match the language in the city's comprehensive plan.
The Sophia Travis Playground at Karst Farm Park is getting a bit of a makeover. In their meeting yesterday, the Monroe County Commissioners approved spending $96,000 to remove concrete and asphalt surfaces and restore grass to the site. Assistant Administrator for Parks and Rec Kelly Whitmer says the work will begin January 22nd. She anticipates the playground will reopen May 25th.
Then in September, we're going to take out the playground for 3 weeks after the children go back to school to do the ADA ramps.
Great. Whitmer says the playground on South Enright Road was originally created with a Kellogg Foundation grant. It was designed to exceed standards set by the Americans with Disabilities Act.
Mm-hmm. That if you're a parent and you have a disability, that you have access to go play with your children and interact with your children. Or if your child has a disability, that they can interact with their brothers and sisters and friends in the same manner. And that is how the playscape area was designed. The splash pad, we have wheelchairs out there. People can get out of their wheelchairs or equipment, use our wheelchairs, go in the water, play, dry off, get into theirs. The playground right now, before the renovation, has a built-in ramp. So if you want to wheelchair up to every activity, you can currently. So when we go to do the renovation, the ramp system that's there now will no longer be. It is not a playground unit. It's concrete. It will all be gone.
Whitmer assured commissioners the playground will meet ADA standards when it reopens in May with a transfer station. But she says the wheelchair ramps still need to be replaced.
Let me tell you what a transfer station is. It's a very large step. You're in your wheelchair, you approach, you need to get out of your wheelchair. Someone has to carry your wheelchair up the stairs. You have to then get up the stairs, then get back in your wheelchair. That is compliant, but as you and I know, that is not ideal.
Whitmer says the money allocated by the Board of Park Commissioners to renovate the playscape does not include the roughly $70,000 needed to replace the wheelchair ramps. Commissioner Administrator Angie Purdy is working with Whitmer to explore other possible funding sources. In other news, Commissioner Julie Thomas says many of the county boards and commissions that have vacancies that need to be filled by February.
These include the Alcohol Beverage Board, Animal Management Commission, Aviation Board, Board of Health, Cemetery Commission, Drainage Board, Economic Development Commission, Emergency Management Advisory Council, Environmental Commission, Fair Board, Historic Preservation Board of Review, Human Rights Commission, Monroe County Licensing Board, Parks and Recreation Board, Property Tax Assessment Board of Appeals, Plan Review Committee and Plat Committee. Both of those are through the Plan Commission, but we will forward your application to the Plan Commission. And those are actually due this week, over this next week, if you can do this, because the Plan Commission is meeting next week. Redevelopment Commission, Traffic Commission, and the Women's Commission.
The Monroe County Commissioners will meet again on January 17th at 10 a.m.
The Indiana Legislature reconvened earlier this week. One of the items on their agenda will be a revision of Indiana's alcohol laws. An Indiana Senate committee approved a bill allowing carryout alcohol sales on Sundays. Currently, Sunday alcohol sales are prohibited from stores. That law is left over from Prohibition and comes up in the legislature almost every year. Senate Bill 1 would allow retailers to sell alcohol from noon to 8 p.m. on Sundays. The Senate Public Policy Committee approved the bill yesterday. It will need to be brought up for debate on the state Senate floor. The bill is brought up for debate, brought up to a vote, and approved in the Indiana State Senate, it will go to the State House Representatives. Senate Bill 1 is authored by Lafayette Republican Ron Dalting.
Indiana Governor Eric Holcomb addressed the state legislature on Tuesday night after its opening session. The governor's annual State of the State address focused on Indiana's economy.
2018 is all about taking those tools that we've been provided and putting them to work for a single purpose in mind, to make life better for all Hoosiers. So the question before us now is, what must we do to make sure every Hoosier has the opportunity to take part in the growing bounty our state has to offer? And that's why this year, my focus can be summed up in three words. People, people, people.
Governor Holcomb outlined five areas he would like to focus on during his tenure, which he refers to as his five pillars: to diversify the economy, improve state infrastructure, strengthen the workforce, improve government services, and attack the opioid crisis.
Of course, our people include our most vulnerable. Despite focused efforts, Indiana's infant mortality rate is unacceptable. Indiana regularly ranks among the worst states in the nation for infant mortality, lagging behind the national average and that of our Midwestern neighbors. 623 babies didn't live past the age of one in Indiana in 2016. 623. We can and we will save more of them.
Holcomb's office was recently criticized by the Department of Child Services Director Mary Beth Bonaventura, who wrote in a scathing resignation letter that the state policies would, quote, all but ensure children will die, unquote. Reporting live for WFHB, I'm Carolyn Vandeweel.
And I'm Ron Bronson. Support for WFHB is provided by attorneys Eric Slotograph and Ben Neoff. Slotograph Neoff is located at 200 East 3rd Street in downtown Bloomington, assisting families and small businesses in meeting the legal challenges of life, providing estate planning and wills, as well as family law services. More information is available at 812-332-6000 or online at slotographlegal.com. Slotograph Neoff, law for business, community, and life.
Indiana's legislature passed a law last session that requires police to collect DNA from people arrested in conjunction with a felony. That law went into effect January 1st. The DNA, which is collected with a cotton swab from the inside of a person's mouth, goes into a federal database. In today's feature report, WFHB News Director Wes Martin speaks with Indiana Prosecuting Attorneys Council Executive Director David Powell about their support for the law. We'll then hear from Katie Blair with the Indiana chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union.
Mr. Powell, you're the executive director of the Prosecuting Attorneys Council. My understanding from a press release that we received was that the Prosecuting Attorneys Council supported lawmakers who passed a DNA collection for people accused of a felony. Could you speak as to why exactly that was the case and a little bit more about that legislation?
Yeah, Indiana was one of a minority of states that didn't have DNA connection on felony arrest. So it's, you know, have to be charged with a felony. Obviously, there has to be probable cause for that felony charge, and then a warrant issued. And if you're arrested, then DNA is collected. Currently, prior to this legislation, we had DNA collection on felony, felony conviction only. And there's a lot of folks that do get arrested that we don't have their DNA. And having the DNA in its system does two things. It often helps exonerate people or help us find people who have committed crime, especially in the world of sex crimes. There are folks who, if we have their DNA, we often may have a victim of a sex crime where we have a DNA collection, but we don't know who it is. And unless they're a convicted felon, their DNA would not be in the system in Indiana. We've had a couple of cases in Indiana, one involving homicide and other rape-type cases where they have been cold cases solved due to a DNA connection collection in another state, which then went into the federal DNA database. And so all this does is if you're convicted or charged with a felony and you're arrested for that felony, there's a buccal swab, which is a saliva swab, taken, and then that DNA is put in the system. Really not any different than the fingerprints we do now take, so it's a candidly a better fingerprint, and it just helps public safety. It helps us solve crimes. It helps us match that DNA up with unsolved cold cases, and oftentimes if someone's falsely accused, it may exonerate that individual as well by pinpointing the right person. So it just enhances a collection of evidence that is truthful and reliable. So
it's my understanding this legislation passed this past year. Presumably some of these people who are charged with felonies would be innocent, and yet their DNA would be...
If they're innocent, their fingerprints are still collected, and if they're innocent, they got nothing to worry about. You're assuming that DNA collection is a penalty. How is that punitive? It only matches other DNA evidence. So, you know, I think that's the wrong assumption. There are probably some folks that think that way, but for law-abiding citizens, I mean, I'd be happy to give my DNA up. But the only people who would have fear for submitting their DNA are people who have committed crimes, typically, that are out there that have not been solved. So it helps us catch those serial rapists and other folks that have not been held accountable because we haven't had a DNA in the database. So for that assumption to fly, you have to assume that collection of DNA in a buccal swab is punitive. It's not intrusive. It's easy, any more than collection of fingerprints are. And we've been doing that for decades. So if you've not committed a crime and where evidence has been collected from blood, saliva, body tissue, or semen or something like that, you got nothing to worry about.
What about people who, I think fingerprints are one thing. I think turning over your DNA to the state is quite a different thing.
It goes into the federal database, and that is for law enforcement use only. There's a lot of folks that want to suggest that somehow is turned over for experimentation or medical science or research or discoverable to the public. None of that's true. I mean, it is purely for law enforcement detection, public safety purposes. No one's playing around with the DNA, you know, fooling with it, you know, mixing it together, doing any of that kind of stuff. It's just like fingerprints. It's in a computer-generated database that law enforcement can access for purposes of identifying offenders.
Mr. Powell, how many other states have similar legislation like this on the books?
31.
And does that include Indiana?
No, we became, I think, the 31st. So we were kind of behind the times on that. And what really brought it to light, there was an old elder couple recently murdered in their home. It was unsolved, but there was blood there. And it turns out that blood matched out of a felony arrest of an individual from Ohio. Turns out they lived in Indianapolis. And after that was identified, this was the same person that shot up a police station in Indianapolis. You know, that case probably brought it to light as much as anything because of the good it did. And, you know, the argument was, why should we have to rely on people being arrested in other states to solve crimes in Indiana? But the Ohio felony arrest DNA connection, there's also a case in northern Indiana where a Florida collection solved a very old rape cold case of an elder woman. So, I mean, I don't know of any bad news coming out of it. Where it has been done, it's done nothing but to make our community safer from the worst kind of offenders, to be honest, people by and large that harm people. But I would think females and people who have been victims of sex crimes, especially those that are unsolved and homicides that are unsolved, you've got had a couple of those in Monroe County with college students. This advances law enforcement detection to hopefully help us solve some of those horrible cases.
Mr. Powell, thank you very much for speaking with us. I appreciate you taking the time.
You're welcome.
The bill has been passed in other states. Unfortunately, it has been found constitutional. We have some major problems with it, you know, along privacy guidelines as well as the implications for people of color.
That's Katie Blair with the Indiana chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's been passed all over the place. And the bill author is someone that is consistently passing bills of this nature. And so got a hold of this and we're happy to move it along. So upon arrest, you'll be forced to give up your DNA. So before anything's charged, before they're convicted, just upon arrest. The ACLU believes that when an individual is arrested, they should not be forced to automatically forfeit their right to their genetic privacy. It's been passed in other states, and it's been upheld in courts. There's really nothing that we can do. Of course, I came out against it and did give these kinds of interviews and sent pleading letters to the legislators, but they just went ahead and passed it. Turns out they weren't that worried. But I think one thing that needs to say is also that there is no systematic study that shows that this kind of DNA collection actually reduces violent crime in the United States.
And that was WFHB News Director Wes Martin speaking with the Indiana ACLU's Katie Blair and Prosecuting Attorney's Counsel Executive Director David Powell about the collection of DNA from people arrested in connection with a felony.
Support also comes from MPI Solar, a Bloomington business specializing in solar hot water, solar electricity, and solar hot air systems. MPI Solar designs and installs solar power generation systems that encourage independence and individual responsibility. Found locally at 812-334-4003 and on the web at mpisolarenergy.com.
And up next, our weekly public opinion segment, Voices in the Street.
Welcome to Voices in the Street, WFHB's weekly public opinion feature. Voices in the Street provides an opportunity for people in our community to share their opinions and perspectives on the issues and events that matter most to Bloomington residents.
This week on Voices in the Street, hate crime laws. 45 states have statutes criminalizing various types of bias-motivated violence or intimidation, also known as hate crime laws. For example, assault is always a crime, but if it was racially motivated, it is prosecuted as a hate crime. The exceptions are Arkansas, Georgia, Indiana, South Carolina, and Wyoming. Since Indiana does not have specific hate crime laws, we have asked Bloomington citizens whether we need hate crime laws and what the pros and cons would be.
I'm not aware of that, no. I think that holding to the standard assault classification is, in my mind, the safest approach. My main concern is infringing upon the Free Speech Amendment. I mean, there's certainly a tricky and kind of a gray ground there, and I would hold to assault more than lean in that direction, in my opinion.
I wasn't aware. I think there should be a hate crime law or legislation to protect people from being victimized.
I think we need to have some kind of hate crime legislation just because it's a standard in the United States. And I think that people in the country feel like that's more fair to have some difference between the kinds of crimes that are committed and the punishment that's associated. So, no, it makes sense.
That's good. I agree with that, yeah.
I believe that they are misused sometimes. There should be. I mean, people should have some common sense to not treat one another poorly. But the hate crime thing can be misused and abused a bit. but it should be implemented, yes.
I will say the same. I'm not from here. My English is not really good, so.
People should be nice to one another, and there should be laws to protect them. Absolutely.
Well, absolutely, they should, because we don't want that kind of violence on our streets or in our state. So, absolutely.
Well, yeah, I mean, if they're the only state that doesn't, then, I mean,
yeah.
They should.
We're one of five states. We're not that bad yet.
But, yeah, I mean, hate crime is a horrible thing, and people should be prosecuted if they're committing a hate crime. Like, yeah, okay. Of course.
Yeah, I would be for it as someone that's experienced it, actually, just Monday. Yeah.
This is a tricky one, right? I'm anti-legislation as a rule. I feel like once it's obviously much easier to legislate than to take something off the books. So I think there's always that fear of, you know, adding something new, especially when it comes to speech, I assume, expression. Obviously, I feel like what's hot right now is the hate crime, yeah, and that kind of thing. I don't know what the penalty is for that, but it's probably pretty severe. What we're seeing now is a lot of things can be rightfully so and not rightfully so construed as an attack on a specific group, because there are so many groups now, yeah, that an attack on anybody is going to be an attack on a group. So it does become scary in a, you know, cyberpunk universe, yeah, where no one can really say anything or everything's a PR statement, you know, and I don't want to live in that world.
I think it's necessary. I think it's long overdue. Yeah, I mean, I'm not the most articulate when it comes to political issues, but I definitely think that it's an important, you know, protection that we all need to have, like, as citizens in the state.
This has been Voices in the Street, WFHB's weekly public opinion segment, featuring candid commentary from your friends and neighbors on the issues and events that matter most to Bloomington residents. Voices in the Street is a volunteer-powered production of our News and Public Affairs Department here on WFHB 91.3 and 98.1 FM, community radio for South Central Indiana.
You've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB. Today's headlines were written by Wes Martin, along with Sarah Vaughn for Cats Week, a partnership with Community Access Television Services. Our feature was produced by Wes Martin.
Voices in the Street was produced by Barbara Von Provosky. Our engineer today is Spencer Herring. Our theme music is provided by The Impossible Shapes. Executive producer is Wes Martin. For WFHB, this is Ron Bronson.
And I'm Carolyn Vanderweel. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered independent daily news program.
Stay tuned for Big Talk with Michael Glab, a WFHB news and public affairs program highlighting the issues, events, and people in South Central Indiana. That's coming up next on WFHB.
The Daily Local News is produced by a staff of over 50 volunteers
working in the WFHB News and Public Affairs Department.
Comments, suggestions, and story ideas
may be submitted directly to our news staff via email.
The address is news@wfhb.org.